Welcome to an episode of Arts Respond on WNHHLP 103.5 FM New Haven. I'm your host, Lucy Gelman, and today I am extremely excited to welcome filmmaker, writer, producer, all-around Renaissance woman, Crystal Emery, who New Haven is very proud, and I am very proud to call their own, its own. Crystal is the founder and CEO of You Are You, The Right to Be, a national nonprofit based in New Haven that is dedicated to creating a more equitable world through the use of media, technology, science, and the arts. Today, I'm extremely excited to be talking about her new documentary film, which is a decade, that's right, a decade in the making, Racism, the Deadliest Disease in America. Crystal, a very, very warm welcome to Arts Respond.
Lucy, I'm glad to get a chance to talk to you. You know, with the pandemic going on, you hardly ever get to see people anymore. So I'm honored to be a guest on your show.
Well, welcome. So I want to hop right in and talk about the genesis of this film, which began 10 years ago. Maybe the thought process around it began longer than 10 years ago. So let's talk about the genesis, and then I have some follow-up questions, but I am of the mind that lots of questions should be spread out.
Okay. Well, you know, the film did not start out as maybe most traditional film. I wasn't thinking about it. In 2005, I became a quadriplegic, and I thought my life was over. Like, I didn't know how I was going to survive, how I was going to live. And during that time, one of my friends, who was sort of being mean to me, said, you think you're such a brilliant artist. Why don't you make a film about disparities? And I never liked that word, disparities, because where there is smoke, you know, disparities is a smoke. But if you follow it, you're going to see the fire. And the fire really is racism. And I thought about it, and I thought about the people around me who I know had experienced serious, overt racism. And that's where I started. Now, little did I know that I would end up getting sick. So 3 months before the film was to go into principal photography, I ended up in a hospital. And I got to tell you, everything that ever could happen, you know, not being denied a heart catheterization, with all of the tests said that I had a heart attack. The way a doctor treated me. These are things that I had never experienced, which I experienced during that time. And so I realized that, you know, I think I'm a rather intelligent person. And I realized that what happens when you can't get voice, right? When you're a person, you know, they can't advocate on. That's when I really started putting it together in a different way.
And I want to follow up with that by saying, so this was a later question, but that's how we do. We jump around. So yes, not only are you a deeply accomplished writer, director, and producer, and I'm actually very offended that someone would have the gall to say to you, why don't you make a piece of art if you're so good? I just find that extremely rude, but I will move past my offendedness. But I would love to hear a little bit more about that experience. And I know that it may be very painful to talk about, so I don't want to press too hard on it. But in some ways, you are uniquely qualified to be the best person telling this story, both behind the camera and as you're talking to folks about it. And so I would love to hear a little bit more about your experience, which I know you've opened up about in the pages of the New Haven Independent and other avenues as well.
Are you talking about that specific time in the hospital?
I am, although I will say I hate thinking about how this is not unique to what you're telling me. I've heard from a number of Black women, Black and Brown women in my own life, stories of doctors minimizing their pain, ignoring things like ovarian cysts or early signs of cervical cancer, saying, take 2 ibuprofen and go home. You're going to be okay.
Well, I think that, so I need to say this. You see, because I have 11, and it did not dawn on me until I started working on this health that only one of them was Black, and only one of them was a woman. I think that when you go into a doctor's office or a hospital, you know, you're going there because you're in pain or that something is wrong, right? So you're not aware, or at least I am not thinking about what your race is, what your sex is, or your gender. What I am worried about is where I am, right? Like, what is hurting or what needs to be addressed? And so I have wonderful doctors. Right. I mean, I have doctors that actually will come to my house. So that when I was at that time in the hospitals had just started a new protocol where you weren't seen by your normal attending physician. You were assigned to a hospital doctor. And that was very, very different. And so I did, you know, once my regular doctors knew that I was, they immediately came out. So that's another part. But I do want to make it clear that, you know, I have a great team of doctors and keep.
I'm so glad. Oh, sorry.
And I have never experienced any form of racism with the doctors that are that I depend on and that I trust. But it was being in the hospital with those that were assigned to you. That is where the real problem lied. And simple things. You know, I remember, so, you know, my hands are paralyzed. And the way they set you up is with this little thing you're supposed to hit. And I am a vegetarian a lot of times, you know, but I don't eat like pork beef. And so every day my family would bring me dinner. And I would hear the nurses outside saying, who does she think she is? Mean, you know, or just negative comments. That's not a way to be an environment that is supposed to be healing. Or I eat really slow. This is in general my life. And so to have somebody say, could you hurry up? I have other patients. So, or the doctor that was the aside doctor, after plucking my echogram and my blood test coming back, everything, you know, looked like I had a heart attack. And when I said to him, I said, look, all the signs say that I have a heart attack. Why would you not order a heart catheterization? Because that is the only definitive. He said, I'm busy, and I don't think you had a heart attack. And I said, sir, I am overweight. I am a diabetic. I am a quadriplegic. I said, so all indications say that I should have a heart catheterization. And then one of my doctors came, and they were looking at my chart. they said, you know what, we need to get you a different doctor here. And they did not talk about DeVance's behavior, but they knew who he was. They knew what his behavior was towards people of color. So then I got the wonderful doctor, Doug Israel, who did the heart catheterization. And it's so crazy because I did not have a heart attack, but I had something else. And it only happened just as he was pulling out the tube in my heart do something. But that was what was causing the signs, as if it was. But, you know, people should not have to fight or argue or debate when they are literally struggling.
Absolutely. And in conversation, so in the film, you have conversations with folks across the board, sort of, and you talk to a number of medical professionals and also people in small group settings. And of course, this is understanding, I know I said it already, but that not all of this happened during COVID. It's been years and years and years in the making. And I'm wondering, as you were working on this, what changes or lack thereof did you see in American medicine?
Well, you know what? I can only talk about Yale or SWIPO, right? So years later, I was in the hospital. I kept wondering what changed, right? Like what changed in the way that everybody from nurse or the PA or the doctor's attitude, what changed? And what changed was policy, right? That they had begun to, and I forgot what they called it, but among the employees, they had started a program where you evaluated your coworkers, right? And that could be a doctor, a nurse, a PA, a CNA, whatever it was. And that program forced people to be, to let them know that people were looking at them and looking at their behaviors closely. There was also this thing about patient care. Right? So I remember when I was in the hospital before, there were two nurses working with me, giving me a bath. And these were nurses. They weren't CNAs. And they were talking about what they had for dinner, who did what. And you know what? I'm sick. Right? I'm sick, and I really don't want to hear your chit-chat. Next time I was in the hospital, none of that existed. And so, you know, hospitals are businesses. You know, they are about the competition. They want, you know, you are a client. And they wanted to up their care. I also think that when Smilo came, and Smilo, you know, wants to be seen as the best hospital in the world, that they really force their people to behave in a different manner. I have had nothing but positive, very positive, so the environment changed. So when the hospital started having to do report cards, you know, it changed. I hope that helped you.
Sorry, I was
still there.
I am. Okay. I was muted. It's, you would think after almost a year and a half, or maybe a year and a half, I would have gotten the hang of Zoom, but I'm afraid that sometimes I still forget to unmute. So I do want to, this is leading us into a place where I also want to talk about the intersection of systemic racism and ableism. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what you've seen, both in the healthcare system, but also with the folks that you talk to during this film. There are a number of interviews in the film about this, and whether you think that there have been some policy changes on the ableism front that have also perhaps positively, I would hope positively, affected healthcare.
So when you are dealing with any of the isms, hell, I don't know which ism when I walk into a room, either it's race or gender or differently abled, right? I never know which one. But I think that differently abled community is still struggling the hardest. Because there are a lot of people that don't even talk. And it shows up in how they treat us, how they avoid us. It shows up just in every aspect of, people feel like, when you're a person with a disability, that you should be glad for anything that you get or you receive. Like you don't deserve it. So like you're not a human being like everyone. And it's challenging. It is still very challenging. In the medical, there are places that don't have a lift, right? So if you don't have a lift, and you're a woman, and you need to get a cervical exam, right? Well, without a lift, you need to get from your wheelchair on a table, and then being on a table and having someone be able to hold your legs or whatever is needed, you know, those are issues that we have not been able. I hope that answered your question.
It did. I'm going to ask you to repeat just the last part because I'm afraid your phone broke up a little at the end.
The issues of getting adequate care or having facilities that can accommodate you when you have a disability, and particularly when you have one where is still difficult to maneuver because, again, people don't have a disability that you're of any value.
Yeah, thank you. So I also want to walk it back to New Haven, or not even walk it back, because I see these as intersecting and existing at the same time. And talk about some of the work URU has done in the face of COVID, which of course has been devastating, not only to the almost 650,000 Americans that it has taken the lives of, but especially to Black Americans and to non-Black Americans of color. And so I'd love to ask you first about the Our Humanity campaign, and also about your approach. You have a very collaborative approach, and I love that. So I would love to talk about the Our Humanity campaign and where the inspiration for that came from.
Well, you know, we're a multimedia company. And, you know, like everybody else, you know, March 2020 smacked us in the face. And because we do a lot of events, we had to literally shut down everything. And I was meditating. I was like, you know, how could I be of service? And what I received was, utilize your creativity, create visual or risk communication. So we started with videos, right? We started with creating videos from people, doctors, you know, everybody, the man at the bus stop, to hear what they were saying, to listen to what people feared. And then I started creating risk communication. So those are the signs that you see on the firehouses or the bus stops in New Haven or the police stations in New Haven. They're just everywhere. And they all have a different message, but they all are saying, you have got to get vaccinated. You have got to get vaccinated. And that is really where we started. And it evolved into working with churches and working with organizations like Community Action Agency, which serves a large part of the economically challenged community. Because you have to meet people where they are. Lucy, how you digest information, how you receive information, doesn't mean that somebody else digested the same. So what I'm good at is meeting people. How do I lower your defense mechanism? Get you to do something, and in this case, something positive, and get the vaccine. So we do a whole section in the film Deadliest Disease in America around COVID.
Are you still there?
I am.
Oh, great. Okay. That is good. I would also love to know more about your collaborative approach in New Haven. And then I want to talk about your storytelling style, because I think the two go hand in hand. So one of the things that I am always so moved by is how many organizations and institutions, whether they be places of worship, as you were speaking about, or things like the New Haven Fire Department, the New Haven PD, you work with. And this is not unique to COVID. I think this has always been your approach. Tell me a little bit about where that comes from, that kind of style of working, because some people are going to be in their silos and you are not one of them.
No, Lucy, I believe in collective impact. But I also grew up in right, and it takes a village to raise, right? So I grew up in Brookside. I grew up in Brookside in the early 60s. I lived there for 16 years. And it was one of the most amazing, most beautiful places. But it was a community. At the time, a bus didn't even go out there. So if you had to come into New Haven, you had to depend on one of your neighbors, or you'd be on the hitchhike corner, and you knew everybody that was coming and going. But I was supported by that community. I directed plays in our front yard, Batman and Robin versus Green Hornet and Kato. And all of my neighbors would come and bring cheers and watch my plays. And there was no race issue. Right next to me was Mr. Bronzowski, a few doors down was, Levin family, the Hendersons. And I grew up with people that were regular, working class, looking to better themselves with education. And we took care of each other. So if there was a snowstorm, nobody was coming to dig out our street. Right. We had to plow ourselves out, dig ourselves out. And from there, I understood that you can get more done collectively than individually. I think there's a saying, team. There's no I in team, but together each accomplishes more. We're an ecosystem. What affects you affects me. What affects me affects you. And so I love New Haven. I want to see my city thrive. And the only way that we can address some of the issues, or all the issues, that we experience is not to be siloed, right? So I don't care what project I'm doing, whether it's in New Haven, whether it's in Washington, D.C. I bring together all stakeholders, because we will not solve these problems unless all stakeholders.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think one thing that also stands out to me about your storytelling style that totally dovetails with that is that you are able to both write, so this is not only in film, but also in writing, with optimism, with empathy, and sometimes with humor that is also fierce often. And I'm at this point, Crystal, where I'll be honest with you, I have great stores of empathy and they're running low right now because of where the world is. And so I wonder how you are able to maintain that in this very difficult work that is about a very difficult subject and a healthcare system that indeed, as you yourself said, can feel much more like a business and a corporation than an institution that is meant to help people.
Well, let's get it real clear. They are a business. Okay? They are a business. You know what? At the beginning of the day, Lucy, at the end of the day, I know that there is a power greater than me. Right? I know that my spirit soars bigger than New Haven, bigger than Connecticut, bigger than the United States. World as we see. I am not limited to a small time space. I love God or universal wide, whatever you want to call it. And I live in that space because right now the world is crazy. But if we define our capableness, if you define your well of joy based on the behavior, yeah, then, you know, it's terrible because the state of the world right now is terrible. But if you base it on something bigger, right, and listen, I know that the work that I do is part of changing, creating a new paradigm. Let's not even say changing, creating a new paradigm. I know that. Will I live to see all of the outcomes of that? No, probably not. But I know it's happening. I feel it in the trees. I hear it in the bird song. And I see it in young people. And love, love does not judge, right? Love is kind, does not harm. And I live in that space. And the only person that I can be responsible for. So I am not going to meet your ignorance. Because that means you won. That means that you were able to drag me down to your miserable state. And we're not going to have that. My life is too blessed. I have too many talents. Sure, I have hard days. Tell them I'm a quadriplegic. Everybody has hard days. But and I am grateful for life. I love life. So don't allow what is going on outside. Go back inside and refill that well of love.
I feel like that's just, my heart feels fuller already. I want to hop back to the film and just remind people, if they're just joining us, this is Arts Respond on WNHHLP 103.5 FM New Haven. I'm your host, Lucy Gelman, and I'm very excited to be joined today by Crystal Emery, a writer, director, producer, and founder of You Are You, The Right to Be, and most recently, the brilliant mind behind Racism, the Deadliest Disease in America. You know, Crystal, one of the things that stood out to me is you trace racism as an epidemic that is centuries and centuries in the making in this film. Was that hard to, and I don't mean hard from a conceptual historical level. I think I mean, was it hard to see that and believe that there could be a better outcome going forward?
Well, was it hard? No, it's not hard. All you got to do is go look. Probably there's a lot of people don't want to bother to go look. That's number one. Was it hard emotionally and spiritually? Sure, to see the genocide and the brutality on any person, is hard on the psyche. It's hard on the heart if you have a heart. But the story had to be told. There are sections that I still cannot rewatch just because they're painful. But we are getting better because of technology. Right? Technology makes things that happen, we can see them sooner. Father happening. Right? There's no doubt of what happened in January 2021 when the Hill was savagely attacked.
That's right.
Without television, without Facebook, right? Without technology, a lot of those people would have gotten away with that. Right? So it is getting better. People's eyes are slowly open, those that want to open. But here's the thing about change. Change is a not even a theory. Change is an action that's guaranteed. There will always be change. If you do not change, you die. So that old thought that would hold on to racism, that would kill its own to hold on, that eventually will die. And I will definitely be here to bury it. So,
yeah.
It's happening. It's happening, not as fast as we like it to happen, but it's happening. I know every day that the world is part of that.
I also, from that, I want to talk about the distribution of this information. So, of course, not only is this a deeply meaningful documentary, but it is a deeply educational one, I believe, for many, if not all, who watch it. And so I'm wondering what your hopes are for the distribution of this documentary and the audiences, which when I was watching it, I thought could range from and should range from school children all the way up to people in their 90s and their early 100s, because everyone should see this.
Well, it's for everyone. And it's not just a black, white thing. It's for everyone that has a heart, for everyone that cares. And then it's for those that don't care, that need to be shown. This is what your behavior has created. So, and that is one of the problems with my style of movie making. It doesn't allow you to pour it into one box, right? Or because we are multidimensional people, right? I mean, we all are. And we need to absorb information in different ways. And that is what my goal was. And I think that art can be utilized to really help people lower their defense. Right? Because art can be universal.
Yeah.
Now we just got to work on getting a distributor.
Yeah.
But it took 10 years to make So it's not going to take 10 years to get a distributor.
That's right. That's right. So I want to hop back to, or not even hop back to, because it's in the film, the fact that we're seeing that COVID-19 is not over, despite, I think, what some Americans think. I often feel like I'm living in two universes, one where people are very gentle and mindful of themselves and also of each other and act like each other's keeper, and another where the COVID fatigue is very real and Americans are ready to be done, so they're pretending that it doesn't exist anymore. And I'm wondering what discussions you are having. You know, Our Humanity, the banner campaign launched in early March of this year, which was about the 12-month mark of the COVID-19 pandemic. What discussions are you having with folks in your own life around the fact that this is still continuing and part of the problem is distrust around the vaccine?
No, part of the problem is narcissism. Let's call it what it is. Not about distrust. And I think, Lucy, when you say distrust around the vaccine, you're implying that that is to people of color. So when you really look at statistics, that there are just as many white people in Connecticut that are not vaccinated. I can tell you off the top of my hand, five of my good friends that have chosen not to be vaccinated. And that is because they're narcissists. They only care about, can only see the world through a very small lens. But that lens is about themselves. And so they buy into facts. So they buy into myths that are not facts. They tell themselves, that this is a hoax or this is the government, but they don't see the numbers of people dying, and particularly those whose families have not been touched by COVID, whose families have not lost someone. I find that when you're talking with family members that have lost one or two people, they are more available now to get the vaccine. When you talk to somebody who has had, I'm athlete friend of mine, has had COVID. Many of his family has had COVID. They did not get vaccinated. They still won't get vaccinated. As my brothers told me, he's had COVID twice, so why should he get vaccinated? It's a lot of incorrect understanding. And so I talk to people, and depending on who I'm talking to, depends on what I say.
Yeah. I will say that I have met and spoken to a number of, I would say I am seeing this among, in Connecticut, white people who voted for Trump, as not to put anyone in a box. I am especially seeing that, this, if you want to call it narcissism or distrust. I've also seen a wait and see crowd. And I'm curious for you, my answer is usually some form of just get the damn shot. And that is not perhaps the most effective, and I need to be doing a better job of meeting people where they are. But I'm wondering for you, is your answer with them also just stop being narcissistic?
No, my answer is always the same to whoever I'm talking about.
Yeah.
If I'm talking to people of color, not getting the vaccine, you are complicit in creating our own genocide. That there are people that want us to die, so you're just helping them along. To other people who say there's not enough data, I start speaking data to them. I start emailing them. I give you enough data that you just get sick of me. And then the Trump-type supporters who are running around here anti-everything. You know what? You're not going to be able to persuade them, right? So God has to come strike them with lightning to, like, change their mindset. And there are some that you are not going to be able to convince. My work is letting you know that you have options, creating it in a manner that is digestible to you, wherever you are, or whatever level you are. And, you know, it does what it does. You know, I mean, our vaccine pop-up rates, as we do 150 people, as we do 20 people. What I say is that every person that we assist to get a vaccine, saving a life, and probably lives around.
And I will say, your film is right now at Cinema Village, showing this month. I have their website.
It's showing for a week. Cinema Village. Yeah, Cinema Village Theater on 12th Street. And it's showing for a week. We are applying for Academy approval. Our goal to get through this week and find a distributor and then race for the Oscars.
That was going to be my next question. You know, what do you see as the ideal future of this work, Crystal?
The ideal future is this work will be utilized as long as there's racism in healthcare. And it's not just about racism in healthcare. It is about racism. Because it permeates all aspects of our society, whether it's education, whether it's employment, whether it is housing, it is, again, it's everything. And so as long as it exists, this work exists.
Crystal Emery, I want to thank you so much for taking the time today to be on Arts Respond on WNHHLP 103.5 FM New Haven. We will link to all of the websites for URU and all of the social media tags. But since I have you here, I just want to thank you for taking your time on what is a beautiful day and a really thought-provoking and important and urgent film. So, Crystal, thank you so much.